The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Philip Isle. He's got a new book out. It's called Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. He joins us on the telephone in, where are you, Rhode Island?
Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay. This is your first book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Vic. It's a pleasure to be here.
And this project kind of fell into your lap, didn't it? And it happened a long time ago. This has been a long time process, hasn't it? Tell us how it happened.
Yes, it is a long time coming. So I first learned that a guy that had gone to medical school with my dad, actually college and medical school, a guy named Paul Volkman, was under federal indictment from the U.S. Department of Justice for really a horrifying set of alleged crimes down in southern Ohio. I first learned about him in 2009, about 2 years after his indictment. And at the time, I was 23 years old. I was just starting out as a journalist. I had written a handful of short, kind of lighthearted articles for local publications here in Rhode Island. But one of the books that had made me want to get into writing and nonfiction writing in the first place was Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. So with that book as kind of one of my North Stars, I am going about my life as a recent college graduate, aspiring journalist, and I overhear my dad tell me about this kind of long-lost classmate of his who was in this extraordinary legal situation of facing charges of being essentially a prescription drug-dealing kingpin out of cash-only, non-hospital-affiliated pain clinics down in southern Ohio, in Portsmouth mainly, and in Chillicothe. And my dad is a mild-mannered, nerdy, glasses-wearing, golf-playing doctor who, as far as I know, hasn't gotten so much as a speeding ticket. He's not the kind of guy who knows people who are charged with these kinds of serious crimes. And immediately I was fascinated. I wanted to know what on earth had happened to this guy. Turns out Paul Volkman was a former high school valedictorian. He has an MD, PhD from the University of Chicago. It just struck me as the most unlikely story, and I was desperate to find out what happened, and I've been working on it more or less ever since.
And it wasn't like you had a situation where Volkman and your dad had stayed in touch. They had not had any contact, and then right around that time, I'm guessing, Volkman's wife died, and suddenly your dad gets invited to the services in Chicago, and that really threw your dad because he hadn't really been following what was going on, had he?
Right. So Volkman and my dad were classmates at the University of Rochester as undergrads from 1964 to 1968, and then coincidentally they attended the same MD-PhD program at the University of Chicago from 1968 to 1974. And that was the point where their paths really diverged. As it turned out, Volkman didn't really keep in touch with anybody from that time in his life. So when I tracked down as part of my research a number of his other classmates, they were just as shocked and uninformed about what had happened as my dad was. But as you said, Volkman's wife passed away in 2008. My dad gets an out-of-the-blue phone call from him asking if he and my mom would come out to Chicago to attend the funeral and the Shiva. It's kind of an unexpected call, but my dad felt it was the right thing to do to go out there. He goes out, learns about Paul's unusual, shall we say, legal situation, hears Paul's explanation of what happened, which is more or less consistent the whole time I knew him, of he's innocent, he's wrongfully accused, he's being railroaded, he's a law-abiding, conscientious doctor, and so on and so forth. And my dad eventually comes home and kind of forgets about it, but it comes up in conversation with me. And yeah, that's how this ball got rolling. And my dad, who was shocked by the news, couldn't account for what had happened basically in between their graduation from med school and this indictment in 2007. So that was kind of the mystery that drew me in.
If you're just tuning in, it's the Book Nook. My guest is Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And you had a unique opportunity here because the fact that your dad was his old classmate gave you an opportunity to interview this guy, and you did a lot of interviewing with him, and he was open with you because of your dad's connection. He opened his heart to you, and this is a guy who we can understand why he didn't stay in touch with your father, because he didn't really seem to have any friends, yet he really cared about people. He really did, didn't he? What, this guy, he's like a monster. He's unbelievable. You bring him alive on the pages, and we're just we're in awe at just what a monster this guy was.
Yeah. So there's kind of a strain of true crime stories where the storyteller, be it a podcaster or a documentarian or author, gets a chance to sit down with the alleged criminal. You know, we saw that in Serial, the first season that kicked off that phenomenal podcast. We saw that in The Jinx, the HBO series that came out around the same time about Robert Durst. And yeah, as it turned out, I had the opportunity to sit down at length with Paul Volkman before his trial. I sent him a letter basically right after I learned about his case, asking him if he'd be up for speaking with me. I do want to say, you know, maybe the fact that I was his old classmate's son helped open the door a bit. But given what I later learned about Volkman and what is in the book, I think he would have opened his heart to just about any journalist who showed up and said, hey, I want to hear your version of the story. I happen to have the interest because of his personal connection. But he's the kind of guy who will share his story of victimhood as he sees it with just about anyone. So I went out to Chicago for the first time to meet him in December of 2009, which turned out to be about 2 years before his trial. I returned the following summer. Overall, I had about 15 hours of in-person sit-down recorded interviews recorded with his permission with a tape recorder. And after his conviction, we continued to correspond when he was in county prison and federal prison for years later. So the backbone of the book, in a sense, is this guy's own story or his own version of the story of what happened in his life. But as you know, Vic, if you've read the book, he's hardly a reliable narrator. And when I fact-checked his story, which I did at every turn, there were exaggerations, there were outright fabrications, and at the most critical junctures, his alleged crimes, there was an entire community that basically saw things the opposite of how he saw it. Folks down in Scioto County in southern Ohio do not see the doctors who came in and worked for these cash-only pain clinics as genuinely helpful actors. They see them as criminals, pretty much.
You build the story. You take us all the way through his life. He was an unhappy child. He hated his parents. He ended up becoming a doctor, and he started off being a pediatrician. But this guy had a degree in pharmacology as well, and he got himself into a lot of trouble for malpractice. You take us through his malpractice suits. You take us through his loss of malpractice insurance. It's really kind of miraculous to read about his career path, because this guy shouldn't have been practicing medicine at all early on. And he did this thing where he would go and he would work at various hospitals. He really needed to generate money. He was married to a woman who expected the best. They lived in a beautiful apartment overlooking the lake in Chicago. And he had a very expensive lifestyle. So he needed cash. So he would work at all these different hospitals. And that's how he eventually ended up in southern Ohio, by doing this rent-a-doctor gig.
Right. Locum tenens is the technical term but in the medical world. But yes, he had a really unusual medical trajectory, as you just laid out. He and my dad were trained to be medical researchers, which really means they weren't supposed to see patients at all. They were supposed to be mostly in laboratories, you know, researching treatments for illness and so on, things that would be published and disseminated in the medical world. He flamed out of medical research pretty early on for what he says was one reason and what the guy who was the head of his lab says was another reason. Again, that's a theme in his life. And as you say, I mean, he didn't wind up down in southern Ohio until 2003 when he was in his mid-50s. He had had a significant medical career up to that point. He had worked as a pediatrician. He had worked in local emergency rooms in Chicago. And as you said, he found that somewhat counterintuitively, he could actually make a higher wage working outside of Chicago in emergency rooms around the Midwest, in small towns like Decatur, Illinois, and you know, Appleton, Wisconsin. And so he was kind of this traveling road doctor for a number of years, stopping in for days, weeks, months at a time at these various emergency rooms across the Midwest. But his way of practicing medicine, I suppose, caught up with him, because over the course of those years, he, as you said, faced a number of malpractice lawsuits. He claims, just like he would claim later on with his criminal case, that the malpractice cases were all bogus, that they, you know, he was a victim of predatory lawyers and patients who were looking for a payout. I looked at the cases the best I could, and the facts were much more disturbing and much more incriminatory than he ever let on. So, yes, he had had this kind of odd itinerant career, punctuated by, if you believe him, bad luck, but really his own actions coming back to haunt him, and that was what set the stage for why he wound up working at these pain clinics in southern Ohio.
The book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. Philip Isle wrote it. It's his first book, and I'll continue my conversation with Phil right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. I've been joined on the telephone in Rhode Island by Philip Isle. We're talking about his book, Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. His name was Paul Volkman, and he ended up down in Kentucky. He answered a job query, and he ended up at this place owned by someone named Denise Huffman. Explain what happened.
Well, you know, for as long as I worked on this story, the facts were so astonishing that I never quite grew accustomed to them. Volkman, who, as we said before the break, had faced a number of malpractice lawsuits, and in 2003, a critical thing happens. He learns that he is unable to obtain malpractice insurance. Now, it's unclear what exactly happened. Was he priced out of the insurance market, or was he told flat out, we're not going to insure you? He gave me a conflicting account, so I don't really know. But the result was the same. He couldn't get malpractice insurance, which meant that he really couldn't work in the vast majority of medical settings. And that is when he's scrolling for potential jobs online, and he finds an ad posted by a clinic in southern Ohio in Portsmouth, right on the Ohio River across from Kentucky.
Oh, they were already in Ohio. I'm sorry, I confused that.
The clinic had started in Kentucky, but right, for her own reasons, Denise Huffman had hopped over the river to Ohio. She had her own kind of checkered past with this clinic, which was just a couple years old, but had already run into issues with the Kentucky Bureau of Medical Licensure. So Denise Huffman is a woman who has no medical background, no college degree. She had worked previously in factories and fast food restaurants. And for somewhat unclear reasons, she decided well into her midlife that she was going to start as a business a cash-only pain clinic. That method of treating patients was prescribing large amounts of controlled substances like oxycodone and sedatives, like Valium and muscle relaxers. So her clinic was up and running for a couple years, and she gets a call from this doctor. And so they strike up this unlikely kind of odd couple partnership. Paul Volkman, the big city doctor from Chicago with an MD, a PhD, this astonishing level of medical training, Denise Huffman with no medical background whatsoever, and yet she's got the clinic that's willing to employ Volkman in his kind of moment of need. And I think she starts him out at $4,500 and maybe $5,000 a week. And they remain partners for over 2 years. He is commuting from Chicago on a weekly basis. It's 400 miles between Chicago and Portsmouth, Ohio. He flies to Columbus, drives down, and then on Friday does the reverse. So he's never really planted in this community where he's working. And he starts seeing patients at Tri-State Healthcare and, as is perhaps expected of him, prescribing them really large amounts of prescription medication, opiates, sedatives, muscle relaxers. Within months, local pharmacies get spooked by the prescriptions he's writing and one by one refuse to continue to fill these scripts. A number of these pharmacists would later testify at Volkman's trial in Cincinnati about the reasons why they were spooked. They thought the amounts were dangerous. The patients were coming in waves, which was curious. They were willing to pay cash, which was odd. Many of these patients seemed too young to be in the kind of pain that these large prescriptions would seem to indicate. And so within a few months, they're kind of backed into a corner without any pharmacies to fill their scripts. And they do something which is legal at the time, although Ohio has, I think, wisely narrowed the loopholes that they exploited. They submit an application. Volkman, Denise, the clinic owner, and Alice, Denise's daughter, who kind of ran everyday operations at the clinic, they submitted an application to the Ohio State Board of Pharmacy to dispense medications on site at the clinic to become a kind of one-stop shop where patients could see the doctor, receive their script, and literally walk down the hall and have those scripts filled at a kind of ad hoc pharmacy. And so that they were given the green light to do that, and that's the way they operated for about 2 years, prescribing lots and lots of medication, raking in a significant amount of cash, and tragically, as it turned out, causing a lot of damage in this area that was already really struggling with addiction and overdose. And according to prosecutors, a number of patients died not long after filling the scripts that Volkman wrote for them.
Volkman comes to Portsmouth. Suddenly the local pharmacies are inundated with these prescriptions he's writing for these huge amounts of painkillers. And you skipped over the sleazeball pharmacist in Columbus who agreed to handle their requests for a while, and this guy ended up paying the price for it. He's another guy with no integrity. And then we get to their own setup where he is writing so many prescriptions. How did they rank him as far as prescriptions in the United States?
Well, just a note, chronologically, the pharmacist in Columbus doesn't come onto the stage until after Volkman and Denise have their probably inevitable breakup.
Oh.
And Volkman is on his own, and there's this chaotic period of a few months where he's on his own, scrambling. He no longer has access to the clinic with the on-site dispensary, and searches around and finds a guy basically 2 hours away in Columbus who's willing to fill the scripts. A pharmacist who would later himself face criminal charges. But to your point about the rankings, Volkman, out of this small clinic, this is in the mid-2000s, 2003 is when he starts in Southern Ohio, he almost immediately distinguishes himself as a prolific purchaser and dispenser of medications like oxycodone. At one point in the year 2004, his single office in a small clinic in a small town in Southern Ohio becomes the single largest purchaser of oxycodone in the country. So he's outranking, you know, local pharmacies. He's outpacing other doctors. At his trial in 2011, the DEA brought in a guy with a slideshow about how Volkman's prescribing ranked against other doctors. And I interviewed a few jury members, one of whom said basically as soon as she saw that slideshow and how he compared to other doctors locally and nationally, she was all the way convinced of his guilt.
Mm. Well, this is a convoluted tale. I'm sorry I keep screwing up the chronology. No. The pharmacist in Columbus, was that after he broke up with Denise, and then he goes and he's like working out of this house, and that was just like a complete nightmare. Then he went to Chillicothe. Is that where the other pharmacist was helping him?
That's correct.
Okay.
So the entire period of his criminal activity is about 3 years, from April 2003 to February 2006. In late 2005, September 2005, he splits from Denise. I mean, it's amazing that they lasted that long as partners, more than 2 years. It's extraordinary. But for a period of a few weeks, he's scrambling to find an office space. He doesn't want to stop doing this work. He claims because his patients were in desperate need of his, you know, pain-relieving services. Other folks might say because he had a lucrative drug-dealing operation up and running with a lot of momentum. And he, for a few weeks, decides to open a clinic in his house that he was renting on an out-of-the-way, quiet street in Portsmouth. There's no sign on the house. Cars start flooding into this small street. People are milling around the front yard, the backyard. They're going up to the neighbor's house, knocking on the door at odd hours of the day, asking for the doctor. There's a armed guard patrolling the premises with a gun holster to his hip. Super chaotic time. And not surprisingly, the lawyer, the neighbors are furious about this, and they're desperately calling Portsmouth police, who eventually come in and shut him down. But even then, this is now the second time Volkman's office has been raided by law enforcement. In the summer of 2005, the DEA came in. A couple months later, the local police come in. He's still not done. He moves up to Chillicothe, where he sets up a more established office, and that's where he would finish out his time from late 2005 to early 2006, when the DEA finally swoops in and suspends his ability to prescribe controlled substances in early 2006, and he's eventually indicted.
Well, tellingly, at Tri-State, they didn't refer to these clients as patients. They referred to them as customers, and the customers were addicted, and some of them paid a heavy price for their addiction. And Volkman liked to say, well, you know, it's their business what they do with the stuff. You know, I'm just trying to help them. They were addicted to his pills, and he was addicted to their money. What a creepy guy. And he, everybody that angered him, which is just about anybody that exists, including you,
right?
He would disparage them. He was disdainful. He would say horrible things. This person's a moron. This person's an idiot. The guy is such an unlikable person. I kept wanting to sympathize with him, and yet you had people who defended him when he was in court. You had people who worked with him knew him who thought he was okay. I mean, we can always find a way to like a monster.
I mean, one of the things I found so interesting, Vic, was here was a case where a guy was accused of horrifying crimes. He claims he's innocent. Not only that he's innocent, but that he was actually helping people, that he was doing something praiseworthy. And let's say, you know, he winds up being convicted of directly causing the deaths of four of his patients, though he's convicted of dealing drugs to a number of others. And if you were to, say, have somebody convicted of shooting four people fatally, it's really unlikely you would have anyone come testify within court or outside in the court of public opinion to say they got a raw deal or this person was really a great guy. But one of the things that I found so fascinating about this case was it wasn't by any means the majority of people who thought Volkman was innocent. But even after his conviction, there were people willing to step forward and say, I don't believe this guy is the monster they say he was. He was really treating people in pain. Some had worked for him. Others were more sympathetic from him because they knew him from back in Chicago. But that was one of the things that kept me in, one of the many things that kept me interested in this story, the way different people could see it and come away with entirely different conclusions.
My guest is Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And it happened in Southern Ohio, and Phil is going to be in Southern Ohio for an event. He's coming to the Clark County Public Library for their fall series with authors on Saturday, October 12th from 1 until 2 o'clock that afternoon. And the address is 201 South Fountain Avenue, the Clark County Public Library, one of our underwriters here on the program. And Phil, I was just flabbergasted by this story. I've had Beth Macy on the program for all of her books, and I've also featured a book called Dreamland on the program over the years. So I was familiar with the problem. I can remember the scourge of legal prescription drugs and addiction in Ohio, which has now been morphing into illegal drugs like fentanyl because they've shut down the pill mills.
Right.
And this is still a terrible problem, and I'm sure there are people out there who were clients, patients, customers of Paul Volkman who are still addicted if they're still alive?
Yeah, at the sentencing of one of Volkman's accomplices, I forget whether it was Denise Huffman or Alice Huffman, the prosecutor said this was one of the clinics that showed the other ones how to really make it work. And I worked on this story for a really long time, starting in 2009, and it came out earlier this year. And I was able to see, as you said, how this epidemic has been a moving target. What started as a prescription drug epidemic turned into a heroin epidemic, is now a fentanyl epidemic. And in that time, this story I was working on became less of reporting on current events and more of kind of a time capsule from the early days of this epidemic. And the books you referenced, Sam Canones' Dreamland, Beth Macy's Dopesick, those are wonderful books. And I see my book as a companion to them. While some of those books take a wider view or focus on OxyContin, this follows this one particular doctor, one of, as it turns out, hundreds over the course of the epidemic who was in the entire country accused or convicted of prescription drug dealing. But I follow the story of this one doctor who happens to have the longest sentence of anyone, four consecutive life sentences. And that one story took me to a lot of different places.
And it was inevitable, as we're reading, that eventually he would decide to cut you off. When he was in prison, you got kind of a form email saying, you cannot contact this person anymore. I assume he's still living, and I'm wondering if you've heard any kind of reaction through your channels of his to the book.
I haven't. He stopped talking to me. Well, he stopped talking to me a couple times. I'd say the major incident was when I wrote a magazine article about him in 2017 in Cincinnati Magazine. That was really the first time in our conversations I kind of showed my hand, so to speak, publicly and laid out what I thought had actually happened in this case. And much to his disdain, I did not properly describe him as the wrongfully accused man. The headline of that article was the pill mill that ravaged Portsmouth. You know, I quoted him extensively in the article, but it was not the story of a wrongfully convicted guy. Now, since the book came out, as soon as I knew the book was coming out and what the title was going to be and what the release date was going to be, I sent him an email. I thought it was important, I sent him a letter just informing him of what was coming down the pike. Didn't hear from him. When the book came out, I sent him another letter again just telling him the book is out, this is the title, I can send you a copy. Didn't hear from him then either. So I really don't know if he's read it or not. He's in now his third federal prison. He's in Tucson, Arizona, serving four consecutive life terms. Exceedingly unlikely he will be able to get out before he dies. He's tried just about every legal maneuver possible. Those have all failed. But whether or not he's read it, I really can't say.
He's got to be about 80, right?
Yeah, he's 77.
Okay. Well, I would not be surprised if you hear from him and he writes you and says, I want a piece of the action. I want some of the money from this book, Phil. Pay up, buddy.
I mean, at one point he said in his anger to me, you know, I'm going to write my own book. And maybe he will. And if he does, I'll certainly read it. But it won't be the work of a journalist, I'll say that.
Uh-huh. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Philip Isle. We're talking about his book, Prescription for Pain. His first book, Many Years in the Making, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer, and our conversation will continue right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been joined on the telephone by Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. His name was Paul Volkman, and he ended up going on trial. And the Drug Enforcement Administration finally cracked down on him. We sit there and wonder about this because, wow, I mean, talk about blatant. And people kept dying, and people would go in the clinic and they'd go, you killed my relative. And when the DEA finally went in there, they're walking around in the clinic and they're seeing guns sitting out and piles of pills, and how many pills were missing? It's like a million pills from that one clinic. I mean, this is just absolutely out of control craziness.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason, Vic, I don't write fiction, right? I'm not any good at making up stories. I'm a journalist. I follow the facts. And if you had told me this story in a novel, I might not believe it. You know, a guy with an MD, PhD pairing up with a woman with no college background, and they have guns at their clinic, as you say. But it was all true. You know, I went down there. I went down to Portsmouth and Scioto County multiple times. And it was important to me that those folks get a say in the story, not just Volkman. And they all told me about the astonishing hardships they've gone through with these pain clinics. And so that was a really important part of the story for me, was to kind of take a long view and talk about really the entire history of Portsmouth, from its booming industrial days, making shoes and steel and bricks, to the story of how that industry went away, like so many other Rust Belt towns, and what came after. And one of the more incriminating facts about Volkman that I found, among a lot of them, was here's a guy who from his apartment in Chicago is telling me he's innocent, he's wrongfully accused, so on and so forth. But you go down to southern Ohio and across the river in Kentucky, and you hear that multiple doctors were accused of similar crimes and convicted before him. And multiple doctors were accused and convicted of similar crimes in that region after him. Really, this was part of a kind of 20-year crime wave of crooked doctors and crooked clinics in this area that was already hard on its luck. In 2003, when Volkman arrived in Scioto County, I found in the archives of the Portsmouth Daily Times, the local newspaper, an article where mayoral candidates were debating whether or not the town deserved the nickname of OxyContin, capital of the world. So this was where he was arriving when he showed up in 2003 to work at these clinics. And the story takes on a very different tenor when you know the history of what's happened down there.
Denise Huffman, the woman who hired him to work in that pain clinic in Portsmouth, is kind of a template for others. The fact that she had no medical training and hardly any education. And you look at the fact that she was apparently a compulsive gambler, as was another woman who ran a pain clinic. And when it was all said and done, and they went through all this money, neither she nor Volkman had a pot to do something in. They had no money. They claimed they had nothing. This is just obscene.
And because, I mean, one of the dark ironies of the story was that Volkman went down to southern Ohio because he had lost his malpractice insurance. And in my interviews with some of the family members of people who had passed away, I interviewed the widow of one guy who told me that she was, of course, understandably interested in seeing whether there was the potential for a lawsuit against him after her husband died at such a young age from taking the medications he'd been prescribed. And she was told that he didn't have any malpractice insurance. And for that reason, any lawyers who might have been interested in suing him kind of scattered. So that was, like I said, kind of a dark irony of it all.
And the people who died, we get to know them a little bit. You found out biographical information about a lot of these people, and it's amazing how young they were. And in the trial, there was a guy testifying, an expert witness on behalf of Volkman's defense, who tried to make it seem like, well, all these people had underlying health issues. They had bad hearts. They were diabetic. They had all these other issues. It wasn't an overdose. These were flawed autopsies, if they even did one. None of these people died because of Volkman.
That was the line that the defense tried to take in the case, yeah. While meanwhile, you know, one of the things that made this case stick out, Vic, both in Ohio and nationally, is you have all these doctors accused of prescription drug dealing during the opiate epidemic, but as is the case in the criminal justice system generally, the vast majority of them don't go to trial. They accept a plea deal and then get a lesser sentence. Volkman, because of his belligerence, his stubbornness, his staunch insistence he was innocent, refused a plea deal. So as a result, his case went to a trial in Cincinnati in federal court in 2011 over about 8 weeks. 70 witnesses were called for the prosecution, 10 for the defense. The transcript runs over 4,000 pages. So this was all a gift to me as a journalist and historian, because I was reading the transcripts of what these people were saying under oath. And the whole trial was laid out for me. And I do my best to take my readers inside the courtroom, because the back and forth, where the line is between legitimate medicine and drug dealing, not to mention simply a recounting of the damage this guy has caused, was all there in those 8 weeks in the courtroom in Cincinnati. So it was just an amazing resource. But yes, to your point, Volkman and his attorneys tried to argue that he was treating people's pain, that he was a compassionate doctor. Of the hundreds of patients he claimed to serve down there, only two were willing to testify on his behalf. I found that telling. If he was the hero that he claims to be, you would think people would line up to testify for their old doctor. That didn't happen. And at the end of the day, the jury didn't buy it, and they convicted him on most of the counts he was charged with.
It's fascinating to learn about his personality and his beliefs. And you describe him, most of his life, he was very progressive, very liberal in his political beliefs. He was a Bernie Sanders guy. But by the time he became incarcerated, he suddenly kind of fell into his own echo chamber, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's so many odd twists and turns to this story. I talk in a late chapter about kind of two significant changes Volkman underwent after his conviction. One, he had been a non-practicing Jewish guy for most of his life. After his conviction, he becomes a Messianic Jew, a Jew for Jesus, and apparently a pretty devout one. His daughter posts a conversion narrative, a lengthy essay on Facebook, in which he described his own kind of supposed spiritual journey. Interestingly, at the end of that journey, he was still believed himself to be a victim and still furious at the people he felt were out to get him. So whether any of that religion actually stuck is anybody's guess. The other conversion he underwent was, as you said, when I first met him, he was a guy who watched Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. He was a fan of Bernie Sanders and Al Franken. And fast forward 10 years later in prison, he listens to talk radio and Sean Hannity, and he's talking about how much he loves Donald Trump. And he's apparently undergone this dramatic political change from a progressive to a kind of far-right conservative. You know, I was initially interested in these apparent changes, but when I sat with them and when I, you know, analyzed them through what I knew to be Volkman's personality, I found that somewhat less interesting, because I think with him, it's really just about self-interest. And whatever he thinks is going to be good for him is how he's going to steer his personal ship. So it was just a question of not really unpacking what was behind these, I don't think, very deep conversions of religion or politics. It was just figuring out what's in it for him. That's really the best key I found to understanding Paul Volkman, was just trying to figure out what's his angle here.
Philip Isle joins us. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And based on what you just said, I hate to be cynical here, but I'm going to guess that Volkman's real motive for suddenly becoming an extreme right-winger is he's hoping that Donald Trump gets elected president again, and maybe he can finagle a presidential pardon.
There's that. But I also can tell you that I know he believes the verdict in his case, which occurred during the Obama administration, was the result of a top-down, basically conspiracy, whereby President Obama told his drug czar to come to Cincinnati and give a speech about the perils of prescription drugs that would rile up the jury and get them to convict this guy. That's Volkman's professed understanding of what happened. Never mind that it isn't actually true. The guy, the drug czar, did come to Cincinnati, but he came after Volkman's trial was already over. He never gave a speech of the kind that Volkman said he gave, and certainly there's no evidence to indicate President Obama was paying attention to this one case and, you know, said to his underlings, go and make sure this guy gets convicted. It's basically a delusional fantasy, and yet he believes it. And therefore, Obama is, you know, public enemy number one as the president who put him in prison. So, yes, it's possible that he maybe thinks there's a pardon down the road for him. But he also, because his conviction happened during the Obama presidency, thinks there's no explanation but that this must have been a top-down conspiracy.
Well, if Paul Volcker can screw up chronology like that, so can I. My guest is Philip Isle, and Phil is going to be in our area in southern Ohio where this terrible thing happened. He's going to be in Springfield at the Clark County Library. That's Saturday, October 12th, 1 to 2 p.m., 201 South Fountain Avenue for an event, a reading, and a book signing, and you can meet him there then. And, of course, Springfield's been in the news a lot lately. Have you been noticing?
Oh, of course. I mean, I made the plans for this visit to the library before any of this had happened, and the other day I checked in with them just to make sure we were still on. I told them I was willing to come out, and as of right now, we still have plans to do an in-person event, but I've been really saddened to see the way Springfield's been unfairly kicked around in the news.
It's a wonderful community, and I love the librarians at the Clark County Library. They are great people. We've had events there, and just can't say enough good things about them, and I hope it all works out. That's it. 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, October 12th at the Clark County Public Library. You can meet our guest, Philip Isle. He'll be talking about his book, Prescription for Pain, How Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And what kind of a reaction and response have you been getting so far to the book?
Well, one thing I'm excited about on this trip is that I've been through Ohio and I went to some of the bigger cities when the book first came out, but I haven't been down to the real area that was most closely affected. I'm going to be not just in Springfield, but I'm going to be going to Portsmouth and Ironton and across the river in Ashland and over in Huntington and Charleston. So I'm really excited to hear from the folks in this region. And for an event like that, it's just as much of a listening thing for me. Certainly, I'm going to be able to answer questions and read from my book, but I really just want to hear what folks have to say about this whole crisis and the role that doctors played and how they feel about it all. The overall reception of the book has been really wonderful. I got a great review in the Columbus Dispatch. I've gotten emails. I got an email from one of the prosecutors who appreciated the book. I've spoken with a couple of the family members who I wrote about, and they seem to appreciate it. And, you know, that's been so heartening. One of the reasons I spent so long on this project, which was over a decade, was I didn't want to be the kind of sensationalist true crime writer that overlooks victims or overlooks communities where crimes take place. I really wanted to do this right if I could. And so it's been heartening that folks seem to appreciate the work I put in and also the kind of historical work to show that, you know, Portsmouth and Appalachia generally were really victimized by outside forces, be they large pharmaceutical companies or desperate, down on their luck, unscrupulous doctors like Paul Volcker, who came in and made a buck and then flew back to Chicago when it was all done.
Well, I'm sure that you're expecting when you appear in places like Portsmouth, Ironton, Ashland, that you're going to encounter people who have firsthand experience with the scourge of opiates and the addictions and the deaths and the tragedy. And that's going to be a really powerful tour for you.
I hope so, and I'm eager to see those folks. I mean, that was one as the timing of this project worked out, it just so happened that I went to Chicago to hear Volkman's story first before my first trip to Portsmouth, my first of 10 trips to Portsmouth. And he was so smart and so manipulative and knew so many details that you could almost buy his story if you were just sitting in Chicago listening to him tell it. But the minute you arrive in Portsmouth and you start going around and asking people about these pain clinics and what they thought of them, any kind of suspension of disbelief around Volkman just disappears. because nobody down there believes that guys like him were doing the right thing. And as you said, you don't have to go very far to find people affected by this overdose epidemic. You don't have to go far at all. You know, people don't just have one connection. They often have multiple connections, family members or cousins or friends or classmates. So that's what I wanted to do with this book, was give people the experience of listening to Volkman, but also of traveling down to this place, which is a really special place that fell on some hard times. And yeah, I'm so grateful I had the opportunity, and I'm excited to hear from those folks and to hear what they think of this story.
Philip, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for being our guest today on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a real pleasure.
My guest has been Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And once again, Phil will be at the Clark County Library Saturday, October 12th. From 1 until 2 o'clock, that's at 201 South Fountain Avenue in beautiful Springfield, Ohio. And I do have one other author event at a library that I want to tell you about. I got a note in the mail about this, and I respect the U.S. Mail tremendously. And this was from Juanita up in Piqua, who I met last year when I interviewed Sharon Short, or Jess Montgomery, as her pen name is, at the library at Edison Community College in Piqua. Actually, it wasn't the library. It was an auditorium. But it was sponsored by a bunch of libraries. I love libraries. And Juanita sent me this note. She thought you'd want to know about this. John Scalzi, who's probably the best-known author in Southwest Ohio, who lives over in Bradford, is going to be doing an event on October 15th at 6:30 p.m. He will be speaking about his latest work. And according to this announcement that Juanita sent me, it says, join us at the Fort Piqua Plaza October 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear John Scalzi. And it says free tickets are available at the circulation desk, and that would be the desk at the Piqua Public Library. And I remembered Juanita when she sent me this note. I immediately remembered her because after I did my interview with Sharon in Piqua last year, she was there in the audience, and she called me over. She wanted to tell me something that was really bothering her. And I thought, oh, no, what is this? And so she said, you know, Vic, she said, I read your column every week in the newspaper, in the Dayton Daily News, I assume she was reading it. And she says, I'm seeing you here tonight, and you don't look anything like your photo in the paper. She says, you're much more handsome than that photo. She says, you need to have them change that photo. And I said, well, thank you, Juanita. I really appreciate that. And I was flattered that she would say that. And some of you might have noticed that the other day in my column in the paper that my author photo had changed. Now, this isn't on account of anything Juanita said. In fact, I had nothing to do with it. Apparently, my editors decided it was time to update my photo. So they cropped my face out of a photo I had sent them of me with Donald Ray Pollock outside Blue Jacket Books in Xenia, and they cropped out my face and they put it on my column. And then here's the amazing thing. That photo is older than the photo they replaced it with. And I don't look like that at all. It's amazing. Okay, so thank you, Juanita. Once again, John Scalzi, October 15th at 6:30 p.m. at Fort Piqua Plaza. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening. And thanks for supporting your public radio station. Next weekend, we'll be on the air live, raising money for this wonderful endeavor. Stay tuned.